Coming up on this episode of Inside Pop.
I've seen Blade Runner 2049. It provided me with a night's entertainment, but it looks like I am one of a relative few. We'll talk about the movie's disappointing box office coming up.
Plus, I spent an evening with Riz Ahmed and a few hundred other people at the New Yorker Festival this past weekend. I'll share highlights of his one-on-one interview.
And we'll have Amita's interview with the director of a bold new documentary called Vegas Baby.
All that and a special Big Cell 30 recommendation from a guest and highlights of the first week of the Big Cell 30 Challenge right now on Inside Pop. Hello, I'm Amita Patel.
And I'm Sean David Johnson, and this is Inside Pop. We are your weekly dive inside the world of pop culture.
One of the biggest and most surprising disappointments of the 2017 movie season, Blade Runner 2049 only made $31 million in its opening weekend, despite the fact that it played in over 4,000 theaters. I must say, I am in shock by that number.
Yeah, I was expecting to open up DeadlineVariety.com, which I always do on Sundays to check the box office numbers because I'm a movie nerd. And I was just expecting, oh, Blade Runner 2049 surpasses expectations. But yeah, $31 million may sound like a lot, but the movie cost $150 million to make. And they were projecting that the movie would bring in $40 to $50 million. So this is a huge and surprising disappointment. I'm actually really flabbergasted, dare I say, because I saw the movie and I really liked it. I don't know if I'm going to say I loved it, but I really liked it. And it just seemed like it had everything that it takes for a blockbuster. But let's talk about it. I want to talk about I want to talk about the movie itself outside of numbers and money, but maybe we can discuss why it failed at the box office.
The original came out a long time ago. So I think maybe my guess is that maybe some people just like me didn't see the original. So maybe they didn't feel like they needed to watch this one. And I think you might lose some people just because, you know, we all know how important the female demographic is. And as much as Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford are extremely dreamy in a sci-fi film, doesn't mean that the ladies are coming to the theater.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you my experience. I went to see it at BAM in Brooklyn, and the audience was, it felt like 90% male, honestly.
Yeah.
And it was, and actually kind of older men, again, which that's not how you make your money. It's been true for decades now. Young men drive box office numbers. So if you don't have 20-somethings really excited to see this movie on opening weekend, you're not going to make a lot of money. So unfortunately, they rolled this movie out like a big 25-year-old boys are going to go see this movie, but that's not what happened.
Right.
And I also think that the word of mouth is not going to help this movie, because I think the movie was really well done. I think if you're a fan of Denis Villeneuve, and
I am,
his work on Arrival, which we both thought was beautiful, gorgeous,
oh,
visual,
yeah,
meditative, smart,
ugh,
man and woman sci-fi show. He brings the same,
yeah,
thing to Blade Runner, but Blade Runner 2049, but I think he pays homage to the first one in that it's very slow, very meditative, has an ambiguous ending again. So when I walked out of the film, and we've talked about this before, I don't need to talk about the film right away, but I heard I heard two guys say, ugh, worst movie I've seen all year. And it is not the worst movie you've seen all year, two dudes who were behind me walking out of the theater. But I think it's not crafted to be a crowd-pleasing, yay, you know, the good guys won, and I completely understand the ending, and there's no ambiguity. So
yeah,
I think all that equals a film that I'm going to say maybe it's going to be appreciated and embraced when it comes out on DVD in years to come. But right now, you know, hindsight's 2020, but it had all the makings for a for a box office smash, right? Ryan Gosling and Denis Villeneuve and at least a name that everyone recognized, but also it had all the ingredients for something that will play more like an art house film than a big old blockbuster.
That's so interesting. And like, and even regardless of the box office, I still want to try to see it, but I feel like I don't know the story, so I want to see the original. I wish, and I don't know this for sure, I wish the studios could have released the original, you know, a month ago, or just to get the buzz going, get people who, like me, want to watch it on a big screen to get into the story a little bit. I think, I don't know if they did that, and if they didn't, I think they should have with this.
Alamo, a couple of art houses did, like the Alamo Draft House did play it, but yeah, it wasn't done on a big scale. So
I know, I think that might have been the missing piece, only just because it is a cult classic, right? It's got this little niche that people loved it, but it wasn't like, you know, a huge audience and tons of people loved it back when it first came out. It was still kind of a sci-fi film, so sci-fi fans loved it.
Yep, you are correct. And you know, it's very rare for a film to kind of rebound after an opening weekend. So even though, like, you're saying, like, yeah, I still am kind of interested in wanting to see it, that pretty much means, especially in this season of Mita with all these other movies coming out, you're not going to see it, most likely.
I may not.
And I think that's true for a lot of other people who didn't see it this weekend. It's likely that they will not see it next weekend or the weekend after as other movies come out that grab their interest in a bigger way.
I definitely, yeah, the reason I want to see it is because I'm a big fan of Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah.
I love his last three, four films, Sicario and Prisoners. He's just a visually incredibly awesome director, and I want to follow everything he does. So that's what's going to actually compel me to do it. I don't know if I'll make the time to watch the original before I watch this. Do you think I need to do that?
No, I don't think so. I think there's captions, you know, at the beginning of the movie that kind of boils down what you need to know. And later on in the show, we'll talk about a Big Cell 30 pick. So that's what I did on my Friday night, and I'm very interested to hear, Mita, what you did on your Friday night. Actually, I know what you did. You were at the New Yorker Festival, which I love. I've gone many times. And for those of you who don't know, the New Yorker Festival brings the brightest, most compelling thinkers and artists and creators. And it's typically either a panel discussion or a one-on-one interview with a New Yorker editor or writer with one of those people. And so this weekend, dreams do come true because Amita attended a session featuring actor, musician, and recent Emmy Award winner, and in her mind, her celebrity husband, Riz Ahmed. So, Amita, I cannot wait to hear. How was his interview?
Let me preface by saying I was 20 feet from my celebrity husband, and I completely kept my composure. I listened to his New Yorker Festival talk, which was led by staff writer Alexis Okeowo, who was fantastic. And I think the highlights were, like, her opening question was amazing. She talked about how he went back to Pakistan when he was just a couple months old, or a couple years old maybe, to get circumcised. And, like, it just started off the interview with a great kind of humor and kind of self-deprecation, which he kind of carried on throughout the evening. He's really funny. He's really smart. There was, I think it was a majority of women, and I think it was a half and half, but maybe it was like 60-40 women, and I think everybody was swooning over him. Mm-hmm. It was really awesome. He talked about his upbringing in London. I got to learn so much more about who he is and where he kind of navigated through high school and college, and how certain experiences brought him to be an actor. They showed clips from some of his older movies and something from The Night Of, and we got a very, very special performance of Sour Times, which, if you haven't seen him do this rap, he's never recorded it. He wrote it, he said, about 10 years ago, and he performed it on Jimmy Fallon a couple months ago. I was raving about it. It's a really, really powerful rap.
What's it about?
You know, it's kind of his feelings about, I would say, kind of just the overwhelming impressions of our society right now, terrorism, anti-Muslim rhetoric, you know, like all of this stuff and so much more just about, you know, discrimination and prejudice and race. And there, it's just, it's so, so incredible. It went viral when he did it on Fallon. I think I retweeted it too, because I was just like, this is why you're awesome. Like, you're so smart and you're trying to make a difference and you're trying to put, you know, important and smart and thoughtful things in the work that you do.
So I have a question. I'm interested in, because he's been a big star for probably just a little bit over a year, right? I mean, I think Rogue One and A Knight Of, that was a 1-2 punch. Both came out in 2016, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think he's been a huge star for 1 year. How did you perceive his level of comfort? Did he seem like very comfortable in that setting, speaking about his personal life to one-on-one to an interviewer, but then also in front of hundreds of people? How comfortable did he seem? How much was he embracing being a star?
It's interesting. I think he was extremely comfortable. You know, I think that's what makes him so relatable, especially everybody, you know, in the theater. It was really funny. He would just kind of mention something, like he was talking about his childhood, and there's this show that he loved, and he would like look to the audience and be like, does anybody remember that show? And then somebody would be like, woo. And then he would mention something else maybe 5 minutes later. And somebody else would just be like, yeah. And, you know, say woo to that. And he's like, okay, guys, we're not doing that every single time. Like, that's how he was. That's, you know, great. What I mean? He's like, we're not going to cheer every time I say something.
That's great. I love that. Now, Amita, the more I go to screenings that have Q&As, the more I don't need the Q&A section. If it's a good moderator, I don't want to hear from the audience. That's my feeling increasingly. So was there a Q&A section where audience were allowed to ask questions?
Yes. And boy, did I wish that I just got up and asked my question, because it would have been the best. But I didn't. The line got kind of long. And so I was just like, I don't think I'm going to make it in. And I obviously got a little nervous about it. So yes, there were a few people. There's one woman who just wanted to go on like a tirade about, we still need to stand up against, you know, Trump and join me on November 4th. And it was just like,
yeah, see, that's, you know,
I mean,
yeah,
it was, Alexis was like, what's your question? And she was just very passionate, and he was, I mean, I got to give him credit. He was super respectful.
He has to be.
And so, you know, and he's like, thank you for your thoughts, and move on to the next one. Like, he moved on to the next one.
Yeah.
There was a couple questions that were great. You know, there's two that I definitely wanted to discuss. One of them was a girl who was in college in Pakistan, and she's Pakistani, and she was, I think she was at Columbia and in a Pakistani association, and they were going to show The Big Sick, the film with Kumail Nanjiani that came out this summer, which I loved. And they were going to not support it because of the portrayal of Pakistani women in the movie, and it's something that we discussed. And she wanted to know his thoughts on it. And my husband agreed with me. And he said, I don't think that it was, you know, demeaning to Pakistani women everywhere to show them in this light. He's like, I actually thought one of those girls was real cute. And I like, he was like, I thought she was dope. So like, he was like, I don't think that it's necessary to hone in on a performance and a storyline that may not be exactly what you expect, but it's still telling their story. And you kind of have to recognize that and respect it. There was one white woman who tried to ask a question that should have been maybe phrased differently or just not asked at all. But she says, as a white woman, how can I be an ally to, you know, someone who is Muslim and Pakistani? And it was just like, there was a slight collective groan in the room, because the room was probably 70-80% brown. And it was just like, oh, you're trying, but no.
But here's
the funny thing was, is the groan happened. And again, he respectfully answered the question and tried to say that maybe it was an appropriate question, but also give her some type of answer too. It's just a gentleman.
If I were him, I would have said, thank you for your question. I think step one might be to realize that sometimes it's not always about you. Right. Because like she was like, she's like, I know I've got this brown actor here and it's all about him and his work. But first, let's make it about me and my whiteness right now. Yeah. Interesting. So interesting.
Yeah. So that was some highlights of that Q&A that where if I had gone up there and just been like, hey, what music, what film, what TV inspires you right now? In a way of getting a little big sell from him.
Oh, yeah,
himself,
that would have been a good strategy.
I wish I had asked that question because we would have gotten some great answers.
Well, I am glad that you had the opportunity to see him in person and that he is as smart and compassionate as we would hope and want him to be. So good job, Amita, and good job, Riz. You didn't disappoint.
Thanks, Riz.
All right. Well, coming up, we will have an exclusive interview with the director of an exciting new documentary after this very short message.
I love it.
Oh, good
man,
stuff.
Every time.
Well, I hope that you're enjoying this podcast you're listening to as much as we are pretending to. But anyway, why not listen to another podcast, too? It's called The Flop House.
And on our podcast, we have recently watched a movie, often a bad movie, and we review it on our podcast, but mainly talk about other stuff and, I don't know, hang out.
It's all about hanging out, feeling like you're being with your best friends. Who are your best friends? Us three. Dan McCoy, Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show, Stuart Wellington, owner of the best bar in Brooklyn, Hinterlands, and Elliot Kalin, former Emmy-winning head writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, former head writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Return, so many things. Author of the upcoming children's book,
All right, that's enough.
The Elliot's credits just go on and on.
Yeah, but if you like the idea of listening to three funny guys talk about bad movies, then why not come over and listen to The Flop House? It's available at MaximumFun.org or wherever fine podcasts are found.
So get out of here.
Welcome back to Inside Pop. I'm Sean David Johnson.
And I'm Amita Patel. We are super excited to share an interview that I did with the director of the documentary Vegas Baby. Oscar-nominated director Amanda McCailey's provocative film that follows several aspiring parents who desperately want to have a baby but are struggling with infertility and the high cost of treatments.
They place themselves in the hands of a Las Vegas doctor and his annual contest, which offers a prize of a free round of in vitro fertilization with no guarantee of success.
I'm here with Amanda McCailey. She is the producer and director of the documentary Vegas Baby, which is also executive produced by Morgan Spurlock, who most people may have known from Super Size Me and his company Warrior Poets. And I actually read a lot about this documentary when I was at the Tribeca Film Festival earlier this year, and I was dying to see it. And the reason I was dying to see it is because I have also struggled with infertility myself. And this documentary is about the struggles of multiple couples and a single woman actually trying to have a baby. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I think the first thing to start with is, why did you decide to make this documentary?
Well, unfortunately, like you, I had a personal experience. Condolences to you. I think any of us who've been through this know that it's not pretty. I, at 39, decided that I wanted to try to start having kids with my husband. We got married later in life. I had been very focused on my career, as he was, and we came to the decision later in life, but I still thought I would get in under the wire. You know, I thought, oh, I'm good, you know, like, the metaphor I always use is I tend to go to restaurants right before they close and just beg them to get my order in before the closes. And apparently it doesn't work that way for fertility. So we tried and then unfortunately got a diagnosis. Our diagnosis was male factor infertility, and it was, they didn't have any explanation for it. And that was a real shock to us. We never thought we would do IVF. Even when we went to the fertility doctor, we thought, oh, maybe we just need a little help with some hormones or what they call intrauterine insemination. oh, we were not going to do IVF. Like, we just, it wasn't even in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But the doctor looks at us and he said, you know, the only way you're going to get pregnant is through IVF. So it was a shocker. And we, you know, decided after a lot of discussions to spend our savings. It was about, you know, over $20,000,
yeah,
on a round of IVF. And I thought, and they said, I actually look pretty good for my age. So I thought, hopefully this will work. And it didn't.
Right.
And that was the second shock.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, well, wait a minute. We did this thing we didn't even really want to do, and we thought it would work, and it didn't. So I just was shocked at my own ignorance about reproductive medicine, about my body, about my partner's body, just, you know, how much we didn't know and how willingly we handed over our money for this hope that we really didn't understand the outcome or the odds of. So I was, as a filmmaker, I instantly was like, wait, I need to learn more about this. I need to see more about this.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, it's not the most sexy topic. You know, how do you make a film about fertility entertaining? Because I don't like seeing talking head movies with lots of experts, you know, wah, wah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of in my head. And then I was researching financing options for our second round of IVF, which I really never thought we would do.
Hmm.
And that's when I came across an article about these contests and raffles. And I thought, bingo, that's a movie.
Yeah.
I did not think, oh, I should enter this contest, because I did not think that we would be good candidates for that, nor was I willing to do that. But I just thought that this was a really provocative and kind of controversial way to get into the wild and wacky world of reproductive medicine.
Yeah, it definitely is, in a weird way saying, it's a great way to kind of introduce a very difficult topic of in vitro fertilization and infertility amongst men and women. And the contest that you are referring to is called Have a Baby, and it was held by a doctor in Vegas named Dr. Schur.
Yeah, it's the Schur Institutes in Las Vegas.
Yes. And he held a contest, and couples and women across the country would submit videos basically bearing their souls about their difficulty having children and why they would be good candidates to be the winner of this contest. And the winner would win one free round of in vitro fertilization, which, as you mentioned, yours was $20,000. And when I had done mine, I think it was upwards of like 18 as well. So it is such a financial burden. And some of the people in the film have done multiple rounds. And when you think about that, the add it all up, not a lot of insurance covers it. We were grateful that when I was doing my multiple rounds, a few of them were covered. But even then, the insurance companies were like, you just get, you know, a max of $10,000 for your lifetime. So that was like, oh, we got one, you know.
Yeah, or half a one.
Half a one, right. You know, the medications cost so much more on top of that. So it is such a burden. And to go through it multiple times personally, it takes a toll to see some of the stories of the women and men in this documentary brought back a lot of emotions, which is why I was so compelled to speak to you about this film. It is such a difficult process, and to think that somebody made it a contest was very off-putting to me, but Dr. Schur is definitely magnetic in a way, and he makes it make sense. Did you feel that when you met him?
He's a complicated guy, and that's why I like him as a character. You know, I don't think the world is black and white. I don't think there's really good guys and bad guys. I think the contest itself is a symptom of a larger problem in our culture. I don't think the contest is the problem.
Right.
I think it's bizarre. But, you know, this happens a lot, actually, with films that I work on, where you have sort of a provocative premise like this, where you go in with your idea of like, wow, this contest is weird and crazy. But then when you talk to the people who are participating in it, you know, the New York Times, for example, said these contests are exploitative, you know, exploitative of people. But then when you talk to people, they're like, F you. It's not exploitative. I'm choosing to do this. I have agency. I have willpower.
Exactly.
And I'm choosing to do this because I'm in an effed up situation. So it's just interesting, like the assumptions that you bring.
Right.
So I definitely thought the contest was a little cuckoo. And I think Dr. Scherer is, I'll just say he's really complicated. But I think you can tell in the editing of the film that we try to show both sides of him. He's, he's unabashedly an entrepreneur.
Right.
A lot of people find that distasteful for a doctor. He's also very compassionate with his patients, and his patients love him.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably no surprise that other doctors are not big fans of him.
Right. Like I said, I think he's magnetic in a way where you can kind of see his passion for trying to help women and couples have children and his commitment to that. But at the same time, it is odd that he would hold a contest, and that people, unfortunately, I think there was a line in the film, like, you know, it's not that these, this one person or couple is a winner and other people are losers. But it's hard not to feel that. It's hard not to feel that when you watch this film, you know, the emotional toll that it takes on these couples who feel like it's their last hope. You know, I think he said it as well. He's like, we're dealers in hope. And he is
making a lot of money. A lot of people, this is a huge, huge multi-billion dollar industry. It's growing at an incredibly fast pace. The technology is exploding.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is that the culture, the technology is advancing faster than the culture can keep up with it. Because the culture still doesn't even really understand infertility or have sensitivity to it. And you have this situation of the have and have nots. You know, you have a lot of people, you have 1 in 8 American couples struggle with this.
Right.
And how much percent of those people can actually afford treatment out of pocket? Very few.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you look at the celebrity magazines and you see there's two sides of the celebrity thing. One is you have the headlines of like the $200,000 baby and kind of just focusing on the happy ending.
Right.
Not seeing what people have actually gone through, but just commodifying the baby. And then on the other side, you have celebrities, some older actresses who shall remain unnamed, who have miracle babies at 45 and don't admit that they're using reproductive medicine. And I think that's, you know, that's more harmful because then it gives the impression that to other career women, like, oh, well, you can do this whenever you want. And I think that that can be really damaging to people. I think in general, we're talking about a big for-profit business that's outside of the insurance, you know, restrictions and regulations of insurance for the most part, and you have patients who are really desperate and many of them don't have the means, and that combination can make them very vulnerable, especially to marketing. And I think this contest is a part of marketing.
Yeah, you said it. Yeah, perfectly. I think it is. I think that what you tapped into with that statement about celebrity was interesting because you said two things that were interesting. Like you don't see the process. You know, you just hear and the headline and you hear the news story and you see the headline of them having a $200,000 baby. What I really connected to in your film, as difficult as it was to relive all of that process again, was you don't see the fact that they are shooting themselves with needles every single day and, you know, going and getting blood work and have, you know, and doing all of these things just to try to possibly have a child. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to inject yourself and have all these drugs in you to hopefully get, you know, 14 eggs. And it doesn't mean that you're definitely going to have a child. Right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the things that you're mentioning are the physical cost, but the hardest part, which you know all too well, unfortunately, is the emotional cost.
Yeah.
And the gamble really takes its toll on you. You know, continually rolling the dice financially, emotionally, and physically not only takes a toll on you individually, but can also be really challenging for a couple.
I think the other thing that you mentioned as well about people not discussing it, that, you know, miracle babies at 45 and no one's saying how. What I love about this film is that you are shining a light on this process and you really aren't hiding any piece of it. From what I could tell, especially because I have gone through this. And I thought that was so important because as I connected with you before we even started this interview, and when I first found out that it was going to be difficult for me to have children, when you find somebody else that has been through this or is going through this, the instant connection you have with them, the language that you speak with each other, the way that you can kind of get on a different level with them than you can with maybe your best friend in the world, because you have gone through this similar experience. As much as it is 1 in 8 women, it is such a strong bond that you can have with somebody, because people don't talk about it. But when you do talk about it, there is a community there of people, of women, right, and men and couples and people who have gone through it and who have knowledge, who've had success and not had success. And it's so important to just be open and talk about it. And I'll tell you, it wasn't easy for me to talk about it at first, and I'm sure for you as well. But this film will hopefully help people talk about it a little bit more and just open their eyes to the idea of the fact that this is not a secret. This is not uncommon either.
Right. And that's the crazy thing, is that everyone knows someone who's gone through it, yet there's still this kind of silence around it. Mm-hmm. And the conversations that I do see online or amongst women sometimes tends to be a little bit obsessive about, well, what's your advice? How do I get pregnant? You know, baby dust and all that stuff. And comparing numbers, you know, because it's a very much a numbers game.
Yeah.
And so I think when there is conversation, sometimes it's really focused around the, like, how do I get pregnant conversation, versus what I hope the film brings up is a deeper level of, what does this mean for you as a person? Can you be a whole person if this doesn't work? Mm-hmm. How do you know when to stop? What kind of mental health support do you need as an individual or a couple going through this?
Right.
And for the next generation of women, you know, I think, you know, our generation, I'm a little older than you, but like our generation really has a post-feminist conundrum here. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of women delayed having families for very, very, very good reasons. And I'm the last person to encourage, you know, teen pregnancy or something. But I think it's important that we recognize that our bodies are built to be pregnant at 20. That right. is our biology, and our right. culture has shifted. So how do we change with the times, and I'm not sure that freezing eggs is a solution. You know, I don't think that every girl who works in the workforce should be running out to freeze her eggs, because unfortunately they might end up dealing with the same thing our characters dealt with still later in life and realize they didn't have enough eggs or what right. have you. You know, I think it's important. I mean, you and I are having this like infertile to infertile connection here, but I think it's also really important to say, I really hope that the biggest audience for this film will be people who have no connection to this subject matter personally, mm-hmm. but maybe who know someone or maybe judge someone a little bit, like somebody, because there's so much drama in the movie. It's a good watch, you know,
yes.
like it's not just a sort of medical how-to or help you movie. So my hope is that the fertile community will see this movie because someone else suggested it to them, or someone else right. dragged them to it, or someone else put them in front of Netflix and made them watch it. Because I think those are the people that have had the most dramatic reactions to the film. Mm. And typically what I hear is they're like, oh my God, I had no idea. And I think it's hard to find anyone who doesn't have some empathy for these people and what they're going through.
I gotta say, just knowing again this process and also how to produce a documentary or any type of content, to follow 7 couples during their cycles, because this goes on a woman's cycle in different parts of the country, because the 3 that you guys focused on were in San Antonio, Green Bay, and New York. They're yep. not all in the same place. They're nope. not all in Vegas.
Nope.
So it was that just alone is a strategic just challenge, right?
I always tell, I mean, every film seems like it's the hardest one you've ever done. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just sort of that nature of it. But I will say, planning a shoot schedule around women's menses is not recommended.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Because we'd be like, well, what day do we think so-and-so will have their egg retrieval? It's like, well, let's see. She got her period on blah, blah, blah. And they started her. So, I mean, it's
yeah.
the most amazing conversations I've ever had with my producer. No, it was tough. And, you know, I had frequent flyer miles. It was a very indie
wow.
model. So it was a challenge. And certainly there are things that we missed. But I feel like we did a pretty good job covering the ups and downs and choosing our moments, given how unpredictable it all was and the volume of stuff. I mean, we have a lot of doctor's visits that are not in the movie. Thanks be to God. You know, we don't
yeah.
It was a challenge, but I think we tackled it.
Definitely. It's such a complicated and delicate issue that so many women deal with, and couples, I shouldn't say women only, you know, it just so many people really deal with. And I think that this was such a smart, revealing way of telling multiple stories to really give that full, and it's not even an entirely full picture because everyone has a different story, but giving a good full picture of the difficulty of infertility, but also some of the positives of it too, you know.
The reason why they were willing to share such an intimate part of their lives is because they know that people don't talk about this and they're tired of it. Yeah. And they want to see a change. They want to raise awareness. They want their parents to see this. They want their neighbors to see this because they don't want other girls to have to deal with this. And they want people, they want their problem to be witnessed.
In a weird way, it's a way of explaining it. So they don't have to continually explain it over and over again. It's hard to say it over and over again and try to explain it to people who don't really understand. You know, I've had people who are like trying to wrap their head around the fact that this costs so much, that it takes up, you know, your life, you know, time of your life. Like, you can't plan vacations because you may have to do a cycle. Like, they don't understand it if they have never been through it or never spoke to anybody about the process. And this film really reveals and kind of unveils that this is a difficult process and you can see it. You know, it's different than me just saying it to a friend, right?
Right. Yeah. No, and I think that's where documentaries are so great, is like, if it's hard to understand until you've walked in someone's shoes,
exactly,
a documentary is the next best thing.
Right.
I can't say that that you're going to completely 100% get what these people are feeling and experiencing, but it's pretty darn close.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that creates empathy. I hope, you know.
You and me both. I hope so. I don't think that I'm going to speak so generally. I don't think anybody could see this film and not be affected by it.
Which I think is saying a lot. I mean, I thank you for saying that, but I think it's also saying a lot because there's so much judgment around this.
Mm-hmm.
When you see it as a legitimate medical problem,
mm-hmm,
that is not only a medical diagnosis, but also has pretty significant mental health repercussions.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Then all of a sudden you have to see it in a different way.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I hope that maybe this film will be part of the movement to bring more awareness, to have more people talk about it, be open about it, to learn, and hopefully be more proactive, you know, whichever way it is, whichever way is right for that person.
Yep.
So I think we've talked so much already, but I think the most important thing is to tell everyone who is listening how they can find this film and how they can find you.
Well, it's all listed on our website, which is vegasbabyfilm.com. And our social media handles are also vegasbabyfilm. We're also hashtag vegasbabyfilm. So it's very consistent. You're going to find it on iTunes, Amazon, or Netflix. And that's where we're finding a lot of people are settling into it. And it'll be on those platforms for the coming years. And
that's great.
Yeah, and I think the best thing that helps us, which I've realized about all these digital platforms, is if you like the movie, you gotta rate and review it. And that's not just for Vegas Baby. That's for any independent movie you watch. I do not think Wonder Woman needs your review, although I would totally review Wonder Woman. But, you know, for the smaller indie films, those reviews matter so much because that's how they create their algorithms for what to put forward in people's watch lists. So.
Yeah.
You know, if you're on those digital platforms, please check us out, follow us on social media, and yeah, give the film a look.
Yeah, definitely. I will rate and review all those platforms to support this film for sure. You know, podcasts are the same way. The rate and the review is very important for us so that we also can be found by other people who are, you know, interested in this type of podcast. So we completely respect that, and we'll definitely do that for this film because it really did. It was is such an important film to see. Well, is there any other updates that you would like to give us?
the burying the lead. Well, as you and I were talking about before, you know, I've had my own journey with this. It's been 5 years. My husband was diagnosed with testicular cancer while we were going through infertility, which was, you know, pretty devastating. He's in remission. He's doing great. But, you know, it's been a real up and down journey. We ended up taking a pause and then deciding to work with an egg donor, and we are currently pregnant. So I am not a poster girl. I am not promoting IVF. I do not want anyone to have to go through this who doesn't really, really need it or want it. But for us, knock wood, it seems like we may have a baby at the end of this struggle. And I've put stuff on our Facebook about my own journey if people are interested in that as well.
Well, congratulations, and what a interesting silver lining to this whole process of making this film and then you personally also going through this and finding success. So congratulations. I'm so, so happy for you and your husband, and I wish you all the best for the film and for your future baby.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Amita, that was a great interview. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I want to ask you, you know, we don't always share things about our personal lives, and obviously you got a little personal during this interview. What inspired you to share some of your own personal experience during that interview?
It was something that we had the privilege of going to Tribeca Film Fest, and we get like this little, you know, book that has descriptions of every film. And I have the time this year to really go through it and try to read about films that I might want to check out. And I read about it and I was like, oh my gosh, this is something that speaks to me. And I've been through this and I need to know what this movie is saying and what it's about. And so I think it was more of just like, I have been through infertility and somebody's talking about it. And it's something that, as the film says, is like a dirty little secret that women, couples don't want to discuss. But the more that you talk about it, the more information and awareness that's out there, the better we all are off. Then we can kind of create a community, support each other, learn from each other. And that was something that I did find during my time struggling with infertility. And it was helpful to have a community that I could speak to. You know, I went to a group therapy session. I had some friends and family who had gone through it that I could really rely on. And so when I saw this film, it was just the same thing. You know, I respected her message, and I respected her way of portraying something that affects a lot of women and couples in this country and in the world.
And it seems to me that more and more people, regular people, celebrities, are podcasters, are speaking out about it, because there mm-hmm. is nothing to be ashamed of. And just from hearing your interview and from what the documentary seems like, that is a very, very powerful, just the communication of it seems incredibly powerful. So So thank you for sharing that interview and your experience. And obviously this is, why don't we call it a big sell? This is a documentary that everyone should check out.
Yeah. And it's easily available. It's on Netflix now and iTunes, Amazon. You can find it everywhere. And, you know, that's another thing. Like it's been out for a little while, but it's just still something that not a lot of people will know about it unless somebody tells them. And we have the platform to do that. And I'm happy to do it with this one. So.
Well, great suggestion. And we have some other great suggestions coming up, because after the short message, it's all about the Big Sell 30. We'll have Big Sell 30 picks for Seth MacFarlane, Ava DuVernay, and more right after this message.
What's the deal with Brexit? Have you seen Happy Valley yet?
How do British people pronounce Edinburgh, Leicester, or Norwich?
Not like that.
Are you tired of getting your world news from reliable sources, often with no puns or sexual innuendo?
Why was there a butcher's hat haunting Coronation Street?
What's Coronation Street, and why is Dave Holmes obsessed with it?
International Waters pairs a team of comedians in LA against a team of comedians in London in a pop culture battle royale. Join us once a fortnight to hear the best comedians in the world trade jokes and stories and maybe even learn something at the same time. International Waters with me, Dave Holmes. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside Pop. I'm Amita Patel.
And I'm Sean David Johnson. We have just completed our first week of the Big Sell 30 Day Challenge. Hashtag Big Sell 30. And for those of you who need a refresher, the Big Sell 30 Day Challenge takes place during the month of October. It's our second year doing this. And essentially, Amita and I are meeting the challenge and inviting you to join this challenge of experiencing one new piece of pop culture every day for for 30 days. And we're helping each other and helping you out by making sure that we have a new at least one new suggestion that comes in every day via our Twitter account, via our Facebook page, and, of course, via this podcast that comes out every Wednesday. So Big Sale 30-Day Challenge, it's not too late. If you're not doing it, you should.
And we also are getting some guest big sells, and we are happy to share one with you right now. Kevin Fairchild, who we've mentioned before and have had on this podcast once before, he gave us a big sell, which we'll share with you right now.
Hey, Inside Pop listeners, this is Kevin Fairchild, the host of the Produced By podcast, and I'm here with my Big Sell 30. If you're a fan of sci-fi shows as much as I am, then I think you should definitely check out The Orville. This show on Fox is helmed by Seth MacFarlane, and you can tell that he definitely has an appreciation for the shows that have come before him, but there's a sense of realism, well, as real as you can get in space, that is actually kind of refreshing. If you're looking for a starting point, I would start with Episode 3, About a Girl, where Seth MacFarlane has a surprisingly nuanced take about gender roles. Sean? And Amita, I'll see you on October 28th at the Produce By Conference. Until then, cheers.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for that great big sell. And yes, we will see you at Produced By New York later this month. And thanks for this, because I watched the first episode of Orville, and to quote Mork from Ork, I was about it. And God bless any listener who just got that remark of mine. I'm intrigued. I'm gonna skip episode two. I'm gonna check out. So thanks, Kevin. That's what the Big Sell 30 is all about. Maybe trying something new that you've never experienced before, that maybe you've written off, and now I'll try it because Kevin told me to. So Amita, what else have you been enjoying so far during this year's Big Sell 30-Day Challenge?
I loved your pick of Benjamin Clementine, the song Jupiter. I dove into that song and really enjoyed it. And then I also kind of went further into some more of his music, which was awesome. And you're right about his voice. It's such an interesting, deep, soulful voice. And so I really, really enjoyed him. Obviously, I'm still obsessed with the Annihilation trailer, which is one of my big sells, but I'm just obsessed with it. And and then of course we will eventually talk about your big sell from last week, which I cannot wait to discuss with you.
Oh, good, good. Yes, I loved a lot of big sells that that you shared. Thank you for that Annihilation trailer, because I didn't know it existed. And really, everything that the director of Ex Machina, Alex Garland, is that his name? Alex Garland, yeah. Everything that he does, I'm going to see. Denis Villeneuve, anything that they do, we'll see. I mentioned that one of the things I big sold earlier this week were Blade Runner short films. So there are three short films that have been made officially in conjunction with the film Blade Runner 2049 that serve as prequels. So one, I think, takes place in the year 2020 somewhere, one takes place in the 2030s, and one takes place in 2048, a year before. And they're a great entry point. They actually fill in some plot, not plot holes, but some background. And they're great primers. They're all like 6 to 10 minutes. One of them's an animated film made by the guy who made Cowboy Bebop, which I know is a touchstone for a lot of animation fans. So I enjoyed I was looking for something to big sell on, so I'm happy that I discovered that. So that was pretty cool. And then I love Kano, which is a big sell from JojCast. And he's this British rapper. And yeah, I had never heard of him before. And I've gone onto his YouTube page and have enjoyed a couple of his videos so far. So I do feel like I'm even smarter about pop culture now, and we're only a week into the Big Sell 30-Day Challenge.
Hey, yeah, I am. I feel like that too. It's always really great. And I've been talking to some friends, and, you know, it just brings the conversation. And I'm asking people that I'm hanging out with, just like, what are you enjoying right now?
So I'm excited to hear what you think of my big sell from last week. So we're still up in it, big selling each other during Big Sell 30. So I big sold Middle of Nowhere, which is an early film by Ava DuVernay, the queen.
It was really good. I really enjoyed the story. I got caught up in the characters. The performances were wonderful and beautiful. And it's interesting to see this now that we're so into Queen Sugar and we've watched Selma and 13th, and I can get an idea of her visual approach through all of those. And I see a little bit of it in Middle of Nowhere. And I think it was early on, right? So there was pieces of it there, and it's clear she's grown and added more to her arsenal of direction since then. So yeah, but it was a really, really, really great independent film.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's just, I look forward to the day when there is an Ava DuVernay film festival and Middle of Nowhere is playing, and then right afterwards it's A Wrinkle in Time, and right after that it's the Central Park 5 project she's doing with Netflix, and she already has made enough for a film festival. So
she really has. And in so many different ways, in so many different genres almost, you know?
I think
indie film, doc, TV,
I love
Netflix.
That diversity.
So.
Yeah. That's another segment, Amita. We should do the creators who, no matter what the subject matter, we will see their work, right? Like we already spoke about Alex Garland and Denis Villeneuve and Ava DuVernay, definitely.
Definitely on that list, for sure.
If Ava DuVernay did a horror film, would you go see it? Amita hates horror.
Yes.
Oh.
I hate horror. Side note, I saw Mother this weekend also. We could talk about that off.
And we're not
podcast.
Talking about it. Okay.
You know what it is? It's a movie you need to process, and I am still processing it. And it's just interesting because I've read some reviews about it and different interpretations of it. So we could talk about that later. But so I think that it would be great to kind of put that list together.
Let's do it. So what is your rating for Middle of Nowhere?
I would definitely give Middle of Nowhere a 3.5 rating.
Nice.
High up there. It's great.
Nice. And what do you have for me this week?
This week, somebody who was probably on that list, that's not technically a film person, but a musical person, Lin-Manuel Miranda, your brother from another mother. Just going to say that.
We went to the same high school, so that's
See? There you go. I'm not sure if you've heard this or you know about this. And even if you have, I think it's just another incredible way. We had done a podcast about this last year about pop culture for good. And he gathered a bunch of Latin American and U.S. pop artists to do a charity single called Almost Like Praying. And it was featuring a bunch of artists, and the proceeds will go to help hurricane relief in Puerto Rico. And, you know, this happens often. Sometimes somebody will kind of write a song to help with a cause. And, you know, We Are the World, obviously one of the most iconic ones. And Lin-Manuel Miranda brought together Gloria Estefan, Rita Moreno, Ruben Canales, I think.
Mark Anthony, Jennifer Lopez.
Yep. Yeah. But what I loved about the song is that Lin's part of the song is sampling a line from West Side Story, which is my favorite musical. And it's repeated throughout, and it's almost like praying. So it feels like we're almost like praying. So I just loved the way that he kind of approached this with that one line.
Well, and the name of the song is Maria, and the name of that hurricane that destroyed that island, not destroyed because that it's still there, but the storm that, you know, that brought havoc to that island was called Maria. So the irony is definitely there and present. Lin-Manuel Miranda is a great artist and a great force for social change and justice. So I definitely look forward to rating and reviewing and discussing that song next week.
Yeah, and the video, they did just a quick video, it's a very simple one, of everybody in the studio recording their parts. Shout out Gina Rodriguez from Jane the Virgin. Love her so much, and I had heard that she dabbles in rapping, and she has a short rap on it. So that was really fun to see her do that. And, you know, I think, like I said, it's always good to kind of gather together and try to put something out there, create to help a cause, and that's what this is. So, and I just want everybody to listen to it and hopefully download it, buy it, so they can get the resources they need to Puerto Rico.
Right on. Thank you for that, Amita. And that's actually it for this week. But make sure not to fully say goodbye, because you can always stay in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at Pop Insiders. And also, you can head over to our official website, InsidePopPodcast.com. And there you can listen to old episodes. You can subscribe, of course. And you can also learn a little bit about us. We've got an About Us page that's got photos, personal statements. It's all there on InsidePopPodcast.com.
It is. And you can always find us wherever you find podcasts, iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher. Anywhere you find podcasts, you can find Inside Pop. And you can also find us on MaximumFun.org, which is an incredible network that has a great amount of podcasts that are dedicated to comedy and culture. We're super still very excited to be a part of this network.
Yeah. Oh, I'm planning a couple of big still 30s of some Maximum Fun podcasts. Not because I'm a suck up company man, but because I'm excited about some of the new podcasts I've discovered on Maximum Fun. So that's coming later in Big Sell 30 month. And I just want to give a quick shout out to our colleagues, our sibs from another crib, JojeCast Podcast. Follow them at JojeCast, JojeCast, and also make sure you listen to them. They're participating in the Big Sell 30-Day Challenge big time. Like us, they are working hard to find a new bit of pop culture to recommend. And one of the things I love about it is, A, they've got great taste in music, movies, and TV and comics. B, they are from the other side of the pond, so I think they have a perspective and also access to pop culture we don't have here, so it's always an education.
Always, always. And I appreciate, just as you do, JojeCast for doing the same thing that we're doing every single day, tweeting out a new Big Sell for hashtag Big Sell 30. So thank you, JojeCast. Now you understand our struggle is real as well. So.
It is work, people, but it's fun
work. It is work.
I wish that's the only work I was doing.
Same here. Well, next week, as always, we will have more music, television, film, comic books. Well, you name it, we're going to try to cover it as we always do, because we are obsessed with pop culture. And, of course, more Big Sell 30.
Take care. Bye.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.